Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to John Cowan talking about his education. First, you'll have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer A, B, C or D for each question 1 to 9. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
I was incredibly grateful that I got the place, and I got a real feeling, a nice feeling in my tummy, that I was so excited.
John Cowan, then aged 32, was among the first intake.
It was nice to be learning something I thought I really couldn't do at that level. Then I suddenly discovered I didn't have to be afraid of doing all the things I couldn't do at school. And I was on a new path. I was on a new track.
Planning for the Open University had begun in the 1960s under a Labour government that wanted to open up higher education to more working-class students. Geoffrey Crowther, the university's first chancellor, set out its bold ambitions.
The first and most urgent task before us is to cater for the many thousands of people fully capable of a higher education who, for one reason or another, do not get it, or do not get as much of it as they can turn to advantage, or as they discover, sometimes too late, that they need.
And that described John Cowan perfectly. He was among these many thousands with few options after leaving school.
I'd been to a Catholic grammar school in the north of England, and I'm afraid I managed to leave the school without taking any of the examinations.
How come you left school with no qualifications?
I got rather frightened, frankly. The system was anybody who got 4 out of 10 or less would be caned or strapped. Subsequently, I became more and more frightened. Some of the classes I just would not go to, and I just fell further and further behind, and in the end, I didn't take any of the formal examinations.
After school, John went straight into a job in a factory. But at the age of 30, he began a foundation course at an adult education college. And then when he learned about the start of the Open University, he decided to apply, hoping that a degree would lead to a better job. The advantage for John was that he could study while working part-time at the weekends and looking after his baby son during the week while his wife was at work.
So I stayed at home and looked after the baby in the daytime, and it was a wonderful experience.
What was it like when you got your first course materials through the post?
Quite daunting. I must say, the way the material was presented was very, very clear. It was highly readable, extremely well laid out. I used to turn to Mozart, but I'm listening to Mozart when I'm reading one of the symphonies, sometimes the piano concerto, number 17. But I think the two went well together.
The studying and the music.
The studying and the music.
In this programme, we're going to spend most of our time here on the campus.
It's here that Professor Pence and his colleagues plan their courses and devise their ingenious home experiment kits.
We haven't mentioned the TV programmes. Tell me about the TV programmes, because they became an iconic...
They did indeed. The famous man in a Fair Isle jersey reading, you know, talking about mathematics.
With a beard.
With a beard, absolutely, at 2 a.m.
Now, here we have a curve which we've obtained from a computer by...
My courses tended to be on a Sunday morning. And in the earlier times, when I was out at work, my wife would take the notes for me.
And this is very good of her.
It was, wasn't it? She was very well trained. It was a good relationship. I looked after the baby and she took notes for me. But it worked. A key part of my learning process. I was incredibly grateful that I got the place, and I got a real feeling, a nice feeling in my tummy, that I was so excited.
John Cowan, then aged 32, was among the first intake.
It was nice to be learning something I thought I really couldn't do at that level. Then I suddenly discovered I didn't have to be afraid of doing all the things I couldn't do at school. And I was on a new path. I was on a new track.
Planning for the Open University had begun in the 1960s under a Labour government that wanted to open up higher education to more working-class students. Geoffrey Crowther, the university's first chancellor, set out its bold ambitions.
The first and most urgent task before us is to cater for the many thousands of people fully capable of a higher education who, for one reason or another, do not get it, or do not get as much of it as they can turn to advantage, or as they discover, sometimes too late, that they need.
And that described John Cowan perfectly. He was among these many thousands with few options after leaving school.
I'd been to a Catholic grammar school in the north of England, and I'm afraid I managed to leave the school without taking any of the examinations.
How come you left school with no qualifications?
I got rather frightened, frankly. The system was anybody who got 4 out of 10 or less would be caned or strapped. Subsequently, I became more and more frightened. Some of the classes I just would not go to, and I just fell further and further behind, and in the end, I didn't take any of the formal examinations.
After school, John went straight into a job in a factory. But at the age of 30, he began a foundation course at an adult education college. And then when he learned about the start of the Open University, he decided to apply, hoping that a degree would lead to a better job. The advantage for John was that he could study while working part-time at the weekends and looking after his baby son during the week while his wife was at work.
So I stayed at home and looked after the baby in the daytime, and it was a wonderful experience.
What was it like when you got your first course materials through the post?
Quite daunting. I must say, the way the material was presented was very, very clear. It was highly readable, extremely well laid out. I used to turn to Mozart, but I'm listening to Mozart when I'm reading one of the symphonies, sometimes the piano concerto, number 17. But I think the two went well together.
The studying and the music.
The studying and the music.
In this programme, we're going to spend most of our time here on the campus.
It's here that Professor Pence and his colleagues plan their courses and devise their ingenious home experiment kits.
We haven't mentioned the TV programmes. Tell me about the TV programmes, because they became an iconic...
They did indeed. The famous man in a Fair Isle jersey reading, you know, talking about mathematics.
With a beard.
With a beard, absolutely, at 2 a.m.
Now, here we have a curve which we've obtained from a computer by feeding information.
Courses tended to be on a Sunday morning, and in the earlier times, when I was out at work, my wife would take the notes for me.
And this is very good of her.
It was, wasn't it? She was very well trained. It was a good relationship. I looked after the baby and she took notes for me, but it worked. A key part of my learning process.
Task 2. You are going to listen to an interview about life without coins and banknotes. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer A, B, C or D for each question 1 to 6. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Swedish pensioner Miles Jonsson. Other countries are watching what's happening in Sweden and wondering if they too can go cashless. Sweden has banned grubby notes and faded coins on buses. Many tourist attractions take plastic-only payments. The law says shops can refuse to accept cash. So many stores now have signs reading "No cash, please." Life can be hard for those unwilling or unable to embrace the changes. Professor Niklas Arvidsson is Sweden's leading expert on the payment system. He's in favour of a cashless future, but he's also worried about the potential losers and, in the wake of the Facebook data scandal, about financial information being misused.
This is a growing problem in Sweden, especially the groups you mentioned, elderly, disabled, physical, cognitive handicaps, and also immigrants to some extent face problems when cash disappears and also the access to cash. We also have a problem actually with smaller merchants in rural areas where perhaps the telecom systems are not working. So in some cases, they depend on having cash, accepting cash, and then being able to bank their cash, which can be costly and even difficult to do.
Is Sweden benefiting from this push towards cashlessness?
If you look at the sort of macroeconomic perspective, yes, I would say so. Electronic transactions are quicker, cost less in general, and makes the sort of payment system more efficient. It is a bit more difficult to make black or grey transactions if you can't use cash. Also, from a tax-related point of view and criminal-related point of view, it's a little bit more difficult for the general people to get away with paying taxes or making small thefts without cash.
Isn't the danger that people are putting more and more power, information, in the hands of a small number of private companies?
That is a risk, and this risk has several different dimensions. One is the sort of, if you look from a system point of view, we have the risk of the single point of failure. If all transactions depend on few services, like card payments, for instance, if they fail, there are few alternatives. So we have a system risk related to it. We might end up in a situation where a few commercial banks have a lot of power. The counter force against that is the growth of fintech companies that develop services that can compete with banks. And hopefully we get a sort of still a very competitive market where we don't see oligopolistic profits and too much powers resting in the hands of a few actors.
Aren't there also dangers about information security? Information could be hacked. There, mm-hmm. I suppose, there are also questions about, you know, when there's a power cut.
Yeah, that is a risk. This goes back to this single point of failure problem. In general, you want different alternatives. So if one is down, you can turn to others. So there is a risk of being too dependent on internet digital systems. Even with cash, there are problems if the internet is down or if electricity is down. ATMs will not work. The cash register machines will not work. So even cash will be restricted if electricity is out, for instance.
Do you think cash will be phased out completely at some point?
I think so, but I think it will take time. It may not even happen in my lifetime, I'm not sure. The practical use of cash in Sweden is going down rapidly and will be, I say, in 7 years from now, it will be very marginal.
Professor Niklas Arvidsson in Stockholm. Swedish pensioner Miles Jonsson. Other countries are watching what's happening in Sweden and wondering if they too can go cashless. Sweden has banned grubby notes and faded coins on buses. Many tourist attractions take plastic-only payments. The law says shops can refuse to accept cash, so many stores now have signs reading "No cash, please." Life can be hard for those unwilling or unable to embrace the changes. Professor Niklas Arvidsson is Sweden's leading expert on the payment system. He's in favour of a cashless future, but he's also worried about the potential losers and, in the wake of the Facebook data scandal, about financial information being misused.
This is a growing problem in Sweden, especially the groups you mentioned, elderly, disabled, physical, cognitive handicaps, and also immigrants to some extent face problems when cash disappears and also the access to cash. We also have a problem actually with smaller merchants in rural areas where perhaps the telecom systems are not working. So in some cases, they depend on having cash, accepting cash, and then being able to bank their cash, which can be costly and even difficult to do.
Is Sweden benefiting from this push towards cashlessness?
If you look at the sort of macroeconomic perspective, yes, I would say so. Electronic transactions are quicker, cost less in general, and makes the sort of payment system more efficient. It is a bit more difficult to make black or grey transactions if you can't use cash. Also, from a tax-related point of view and criminal-related point of view, it's a little bit more difficult for the general people to get away with paying taxes or making small thefts without cash.
Isn't the danger that people are putting more and more power, information, in the hands of a small number of private companies?
That is a risk, and this risk has several different dimensions. One is the sort of, if you look from a system point of view, we have the risk of the single point of failure. If all transactions depend on few services, like card payments, for instance, if they fail, then few alternatives. So we have a system risk related to it. We might end up in a situation where a few commercial banks have a lot of power. The counter force against that is the growth of fintech companies that develop services that can compete with banks. And hopefully we get a sort of still a very competitive market where we don't see oligopolistic profits and too much powers resting in the hands of a few actors.
Aren't there also dangers about information security? Information could be hacked. There, I suppose, are also questions about, you know, when there's a power cut.
Yeah, that is a risk. This goes back to this single point of failure problem. In general, you want different alternatives. So if one is down, you can turn to others. So there is a risk of being too dependent on internet digital systems. Even with cash, there are problems if the internet is down or if electricity is down. ATMs will not work. The cash register machines will not work. So even cash will be restricted if electricity is out, for instance.
Do you think cash will be phased out completely at some point?
I think so, but I think it will take time. It may not even happen in my lifetime, I'm not sure. The practical use of cash in Sweden is going down rapidly and will be, I say, in 7 years from now, it will be very marginal.
Professor Niklas Arvidsson in Stockholm.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a recording from 2015 about a project to give London's phone boxes a new life. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 1 to 6 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
And there, standing still in amongst the crowded rush of pedestrians with faces glued to their phones, is one of London's famous red phone boxes. Only this one's got an unusual flair.
We've actually taken something that's really iconic and said, hey, actually, we can do really cool stuff with that. So what we did was we got the red telephone box. So it was completely stripped. So paint was stripped and gutted from the inside. And then we basically got an engineer on board to build the system for us.
The solar box is London's very first and so far only solar-powered, bright green smartphone charging station. University students Kirsty Kenny and Harold Craston came up with the idea of the solar box, which Kirsty says is much more than just about saving the iconic red phone box from redundancy.
This has always been about public space and how we can reclaim public spaces and make them, you know, for the public again. You know, this is essentially provision of power as a public good, and that's, you know, that's the key motivation behind this. And the fact that we can do that in an environmentally friendly way is amazing.
Their concept is just the kind of green initiative that London needs to achieve its goal of becoming the world's greenest city by 2020. With a custom-made rooftop solar panel, the solar box can charge different gadgets, including smartphones, tablets, and cameras. And it's free to use. The creators won £5,000 in a student competition encouraging ideas to reduce London's energy use and carbon emissions. Matthew Penchartz, the mayor's environment and energy advisor and one of the competition judges, says he wants to see solar boxes become part of the London landscape.
I think we were particularly taken with the way that Solarbox put forward an idea which was going to sort of rejuvenate, I suppose, a iconic bit of London's urban street scene and turn it into a sort of symbol for a transferring to sort of low-carbon economy. Because I wonder how many phone calls are made out of a red telephone box these days. They'd probably get a lot more use as a Solarbox.
But even if all of the city's red phone boxes were given a green makeover, are Londoners actually going to use solar boxes? Matt McCoughlin lives in London and says it's what the city has needed for a long time.
Hi, can I just ask you a quick question about the solar box? Have you heard of it?
It's a place to charge your phone, isn't it? Yeah. I think it's great, and it's obviously using solar power to do it. I think it's great, especially with an iPhone, because the batteries just run down so much. It's like you're out in the middle of the day and suddenly you've got no battery, no communication or anything.
Fellow Londoner Philip Wilson had no idea what the solar box was, but said he might use it depending on the time of day and the weather.
Is that something that you would use?
Probably, yes, because my phone, yeah, because the battery life on smartphones isn't good enough. Yeah. Yeah. I think they should put things like that, though, in coffee shops as well, because I'm not really going to stand around with inclement British weather, either inside or outside, getting rained on.
So although not yet famous amongst Londoners, it is estimated that around 60 to 80 people are using it every day. But with just one solar box in London so far, its creators want to see another 10 green boxes rolled out by 2015 and several placed in London's tube stations by 2016. But first, they need to find investors. And there, standing still in amongst the crowded rush of pedestrians with faces glued to their phones, is one of London's famous red phone boxes. Only this one's got an unusual flair.
We've actually taken something that's really iconic and said, hey, actually, we can do really cool stuff with that. So what we did was we got the red telephone box. So it was completely stripped. So paint was stripped and gutted from the inside. And then we basically got an engineer on board to build the system for us.
The solar box is London's very first and so far only solar-powered, bright green smartphone charging station. University students Kirsty Kenny and Harold Craston came up with the idea of the solar box, which Kirsty says is much more than just about saving the iconic red phone box from redundancy.
This has always been about public space and how we can reclaim public spaces and make them, you know, for the public again. You know, this is essentially provision of power as a public good, and that's, you know, that's the key motivation behind this. And the fact that we can do that in an environmentally friendly way is amazing.
Their concept is just the kind of green initiative that London needs to achieve its goal of becoming the world's greenest city by 2020. With a custom-made rooftop solar panel, the solar box can charge different gadgets, including smartphones, tablets and cameras. And it's free to use. The creators won £5,000 in the student competition encouraging ideas to reduce London's energy use and carbon emissions. Matthew Penchart's the mayor's environment and energy advisor and one of the competition judges, says he wants to see solar boxes become part of the London landscape.
I think we were particularly taken with the way that Solar Box put forward an idea which was going to sort of rejuvenate, I suppose, a iconic bit of London's urban street scene and turn it into a sort of symbol for a transferring to sort of low carbon economy. Because I mean, I wonder how many phone calls are made out of a red telephone box these days. They'd probably get a lot more use as a solar box.
But even if all of the city's red phone boxes were given a green makeover, are Londoners actually going to use solar boxes? Matt McCoughlin lives in London and says it's what the city has needed for a long time.
Hi, can I just ask you a quick question about the solar box? Have you heard of it?
It's a place to charge your phone, isn't it? Yeah. I think it's great, and it's obviously using solar power to do it. I think it's great, especially with an iPhone, because the batteries just run down so much. It's like you're out in the middle of the day and suddenly you've got no battery, no communication or anything.
Fellow Londoner Philip Wilson had no idea what the solar box was, but said he might use it depending on the time of day and the weather.
Is that something that you would use?
Probably, yes, because my phone, yeah, because the battery life on smartphones isn't good enough. Yeah. Yeah. I think they should put things like that, though, in coffee shops as well, because I'm not really going to stand around with inclement British weather, either inside or outside, getting rained on.
So although not yet famous amongst Londoners, it is estimated that around 60 to 80 people are using it every day. But with just one solar box in London so far, its creators want to see another 10 green boxes rolled out by 2015 and several placed in London's tube stations by 2016. But first, they need to find investors.
Task 4. You are going to listen to an interview about wanting to achieve more than the average person. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 7 with the sentence endings A to I. There is one sentence ending that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Ambitiousness has a mixed reputation. Back in 15th century Italy, Leonardo da Vinci warned of its dangers.
It is ordained that to the ambitious, who derive no satisfaction from the gifts of life and the beauty of the world, life shall be a cause of suffering, and they shall possess neither the profit nor the beauty of the world.
Yet in her novel Anne of Green Gables, Lucy Maud Montgomery had a much more upbeat message.
Oh, it's delightful to have ambitions. I'm so glad I have such a lot. And there never seems to be any end to them. That's the best of it. Just as soon as you attain to one ambition, you see another one glittering higher up still. It does make life so interesting.
Researching the wise words people have said about ambition through the ages is a lesson in mixed messages. Is it good? Is it bad? And what are you supposed to do with it if you have it? So let's start with a simple question. What is ambition? Neil Burton is a psychologist at Oxford University.
Let's look at the word itself. So ambition derives from the Latin ambitio, which is a going around to solicit votes. That's what it originally means.
So in Roman times, when people were seeking public office, they would go around talking to people, trying to get them to vote for them. This activity, ambitio, became our modern day word, ambition.
And so by extension, it means a striving for honor, recognition, and preferment, and involves the desire for achievement, and second, the motivation and determination to strive for its attainment, even in the face of adversity and failure. So to be ambitious is to achieve first and foremost for the sake of distinguishing ourselves from other people. I think that if we were the last person on earth, then to be ambitious would make little or no sense.
So that's what ambition means technically. But what's it like to experience? Someone who should know is Rachel Bridge. Among other things, she's written a book called Ambition: Why It's Good to Want More and How to Get It.
I started out as a journalist, then I became a foreign correspondent. I have written 6 books. I'm currently writing book 7. I have taken 2 one-woman shows to the Edinburgh Fringe. I have written a children's book, and it feels brilliant. None of those things were probably perfect in any way, but the actual achieving, it's almost like you're kind of putting a flag in the earth saying, I was here. I actually did something. I contributed. And to me, you know, all the amazing things in the world that have ever happened have been driven by somebody's ambition. I actually want to make my mark. I want to do something useful and good to show that I was here.
Rachel Bridge describes ambition at its best. But what about when it's at its worst? The psychologist Neil Burton can shed light on that.
I think highly ambitious people are sensitive to resistance and failure and experience an almost constant dissatisfaction or frustration. As with the mythical figure of Sisyphus, their task is never finished. Sisyphus was a mythological character in Greek mythology, and he was punished for his arrogance by being made to push a rock up a hill, and the rock would keep on falling back down. And he had to keep on pushing that rock for the rest of eternity, only to see it falling back down each time he got to the top of the mountain. So I think that there is that issue with ambition, is that people with ambition are always driven for more, and they never quite reach their goal, because once they do reach their goal, then they quickly formulate another, a higher, different goal. And I think to live with ambition can be to live in fear and anxiety, unless, that is, the weight of our ambition can be relieved.
How would an ambitious person make sure that they're protected from these quite frightening pitfalls of ambition?
I think that the weight of our ambition can be relieved by gratitude, in fact, which is the feeling of appreciation for past and present goods. And although gratitude is especially lacking in future-focused people, in ambitious people, ambition, I think, is much less toxic if, even without it, life can still seem worth living.
Ambitiousness has a mixed reputation. Back in 15th century Italy, Leonardo da Vinci warned of its dangers.
It is ordained that to the ambitious, who derive no satisfaction from the gifts of life and the beauty of the world, life shall be a cause of suffering, and they shall possess neither the profit nor the beauty of the world.
Yet in her novel Anne of Green Gables, Lucy Maud Montgomery had a much more upbeat message.
Oh, it's delightful to have ambitions. I'm so glad I have such a lot. And there never seems to be any end to them. That's the best of it. Just as soon as you attain to one ambition, you see another one glittering higher up still. It does make life so interesting.
Researching the wise words people have said about ambition through the ages is a lesson in mixed messages. Is it good? Is it bad? And what are you supposed to do with it if you have it? So let's start with a simple question. What is ambition? Neil Burton is a psychologist at Oxford University.
Let's look at the word itself. So ambition derives from the Latin ambitio, which is a going around to solicit votes. That's what it originally means.
So in Roman times, when people were seeking public office, they would go around talking to people, trying to get them to vote for them. This activity, ambitio, became our modern day word, ambition.
And so by extension, it means a striving for honor, recognition, and preferment, and involves the desire for achievement, and second, the motivation and determination to strive for its attainment, even in the face of adversity and failure. So to be ambitious is to achieve first and foremost for the sake of distinguishing ourselves from other people. I think that if we were the last person on earth, then to be ambitious would make little or no sense.
So that's what ambition means technically. But what's it like to experience? Someone who should know is Rachel Bridge. Among other things, she's written a book called Ambition: Why It's Good to Want More and How to Get It.
I started out as a journalist, then I became a foreign correspondent. I have written 6 books. I'm currently writing book 7. I have taken 2 one-woman shows to the Edinburgh Fringe. I have written a children's book, and it feels brilliant. None of those things were probably perfect in any way, but the actual achieving, it's almost like you're kind of putting a flag in the earth saying, I was here. I actually did something. I contributed. And to me, you know, all the amazing things in the world that have ever happened have been driven by somebody's ambition. I actually want to make my mark. I want to do something useful and good to show that I was here.
Rachel Bridge describes ambition at its best. But what about when it's at its worst? The psychologist Neil Burton can shed light on that.
I think highly ambitious people are sensitive to resistance and failure and experience an almost constant dissatisfaction or frustration. As with the mythical figure of Sisyphus, their task is never finished. Sisyphus was a mythological character in Greek mythology, and he was punished for his arrogance by being made to push a rock up a hill, and the rock would keep on falling back down. And he had to keep on pushing that rock for the rest of eternity, only to see it falling back down each time he got to the top of the mountain. So I think that there is that issue with ambition, is that people with ambition are always driven for more, and they never quite reach their goal, because once they do reach their goal, then they quickly formulate another, a higher, different goal. And I think to live with ambition can be to live in fear and anxiety, unless, that is, the weight of our ambition can be relieved.
How would an ambitious person make sure that they're protected from these quite frightening pitfalls of ambition?
I think that the weight of our ambition can be relieved by gratitude, in fact, which is the feeling of appreciation for past and present goods. And although gratitude is especially lacking in future-focused people, in ambitious people, ambition, I think, is much less toxic if, even without it, life can still seem worth living.
This is the end of the listening test.